This is Frank Weltner welcoming you to The World Today. By his own admission, Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff is a crook. But that, says Jeff Jacoby of the Boston Globe, isn't the worst that can be said about Jack Abramoff. He has defrauded his clients of millions of dollars, bribed public officials, cheated on his tax returns, and deceived lenders to qualify for a loan. But that isn't the worst that can be said about him either. Jacoby says that Abramoff made himself at home in and contributed to the swamp of corruption that fills Washington with its stench. His emails to cronies with messages like, "Can you smell money?" and "I'd love us to get our mitts on that moolah," oozed greed and boorishness. Behind their backs, he crudely mocked those who hired him, calling them morons, monkeys, troglodytes, and the stupidest idiots in the land. Abramoff played fast and loose with what were supposed to be charitable funds, but not even that is his worst, or the worst that can be said about him. The worst is that Abramoff is a Jew. Not only a Jew, but an Orthodox Jew. Someone who claims to be committed to strictly observing Jewish law and faithfully adhering to the Torah's ethical standards. However, instead of upholding those ethical standards, Jack Abramoff trampled on them. And a religious Jew who behaves so corruptly disgraces not only himself, but all religious Jews. He brings his faith into contempt. He is guilty of what Jewish tradition calls, with disgust, Chilul Halshem, a desecration of God's name. "For me," says Mr. Jacoby, also an observant Jew, "that is the worst thing of all. Honesty in financial dealings is not optional in Judaism. It is mandatory. The Talmud teaches that when a person is brought to judgment in the world to come, the first question the heavenly tribunal puts to him is, quote, 'Did you conduct your business affairs in good faith?'" unquote. A Jew who takes the values of his religion seriously must be scrupulous in his transactions with others. Far from disguising his Orthodox Jewish identification, says Jacoby, Abramoff paraded it publicly as if that would cleanse his unkosher activities. He produced a violent, expletive-filled movie, 1989's Red Scorpion, then turned around and created the Committee for Traditional Jewish Values in Entertainment. He fired off gross and insulting emails, but fastidiously rendered God as G-D. As the legal storm clouds gathered over his head, he cloaked himself in piety. His political activities, like everything in his life, were informed by his religious beliefs. His spokesman told the Jewish Telegraph Agency, while he did not always meet the standard of his faith, he certainly aspired to do so. And these are some of the opinions of Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. You're listening to The World Today with Frank Weltner. I am discussing the news and making comments about the important happenings today concerning Zionism, Judaism, Jewish people, Jewish entertainers, everything that we found in the news today that seems interesting and might be important to our study of Jewish organizations worldwide. We at Jew Watch try to pride ourselves on being thorough and on being able to glean 200 to 300 news stories and come up with 5, 6, maybe 10, 11, or 12 of them every day to discuss in depth so that you will know exactly what is going on among the Jewish elitists and supremacists, as well as some of the smaller Jews who have nothing to do with that, but who have contributed to the news during our day's sojourn. Today we have news that has concerned Jewish gangsters. We have news about Ariel Sharon and the ongoing illness that he has that is extremely serious. Several days ago on the George Norrie Coast to Coast show, a commentator said that he believed that Ariel Sharon might already have passed away because no one had heard from him or seen anything about him, and that the illness that he had was very similar to that happened to Arafat, and he suggested even that perhaps Mr. Sharon was assassinated. Nothing of that sort can be verified or confirmed, but it does make for interesting conjecture. There has been a racist riot in Israel. Israeli police, as a matter of fact, have opened an investigation into how a heavily guarded football match between an Arab team and a Jerusalem team, whose fans are known for their anti-Arab attitudes, degenerated into a riot of fan violence. More than 350 police patrolling Sunday's game between Beitar Jerusalem and B'nai Sakin had to use tear gas to separate the fans, who threw rocks, bottles, and sticks at each other, according to the police. The Scotsman reported that two men were hurt and 10 people were arrested in the melee in the town of Sakhnin in northern Israel. B'nai Sakhnin became the pride of Israeli Arabs, who constitute about 20% of Israel's population, when they won the state cup last year, even though they received the least funding of any other club in the 12-team league. Soon after the win, the Emirate of Qatar donated £3 million for the construction of a 13,000-seat stadium. Beitar Jerusalem's fans are known for their anti-Arab views. Fans recently threatened to boycott the team after learning that the owner, Russian-Israeli tycoon Arkady Gaidamak, planned to sign lesser-qualified players. Sunday's violence began when firecrackers were thrown at the Beitar goalie. Beitar fans then began shouting death to Arabs, and Sakhnin supporters answered with murder the Jews. At the end of the game, B'nai Sakhnin fans began throwing objects outside the stadium, and Beitar spectators flooded the field, striking at their opponents. This is but the tip of the iceberg in occupied Palestine. It is rather obvious from the bloodshed that has occurred in the occupied Palestinian territories throughout the past 50 years that these people don't seem to really appreciate their own cultural wonders. The Jewish supremacists, who are always asking people to live with persons from other tribes and other religions and other races, have not been able to quell the instinct of mankind to want to live with their own people. Meanwhile, Iran has alarmed Israel and all of Europe by removing seals on its nuclear facilities. This ends a 2-year freeze on work there, despite warnings from the United States and other countries concerned about Tehran's nuclear ambitions. The United States rebuked Iran for the move, calling it a step toward creating the material for nuclear bombs. And British Prime Minister Tony Blair's official spokesman claimed that the international community was running out of patience with Tehran. Both countries, along with France and Germany, have called on Tehran to cease nuclear activities until some sort of an agreement or rapprochement has been reached on the scope of its nuclear program. Foreign Secretary Jack Straw in London said Tehran was again in breach of resolutions passed by the UN's nuclear watchdog, and said steps to restart uranium enrichment could not be justified. Straw said in a statement, quote, "We are profoundly concerned that Iran has decided to restart research and development activities related to uranium enrichment. There was no good reason why Iran should have taken this step if its intentions are truly peaceful and it wanted to resolve long-standing international concerns," unquote. Iran announced plans last week to resume research on the production of nuclear fuel, heightening concerns that Tehran was moving toward building atomic weapons. Iran says the research is aimed at generating electricity. Mohammad Saidi, The deputy head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said Tuesday that Iran was not resuming the production of nuclear fuel, a process that would involve uranium enrichment. Mr. Saidi said, quote, "What we resume is merely in the field of research, not more than that. We make a difference between research on nuclear and fuel technology and production of nuclear fuel. Production of nuclear fuel remains suspended," unquote. The rest of the world seems unimpressed by the claims of Iran that they are not trying to produce atomic bombs. We have to wonder whether or not the disinformation of the Mossad and the CIA and of the British Intelligence Service is trying to disinform us of information that we probably would be better off without. In other words, are they lying? All of these agencies are known as disinformation agencies. What they do best is to lie to governments, to people, to journalists, to create spin and to try to create or remove tensions in the world depending on what their governments wish. One could make an argument today that all of the words about Iran starting a nuclear weapons program is designed to provide an entry into Iran by President Bush and Prime Minister Blair, who seem to be egging themselves on for a larger and larger war in the Middle East, despite the fact that they can't handle Iraq. And now your friendly Jewish banker is thinking of saving his company at your own detriment. For the past few months, teams of people in the world's banks and insurance companies have been working hard to find ways to be prepared for the possibility of a widespread outbreak of avian flu. According to Peter Thal Larson, the banking editor of the Financial Times, these institutions hope they will never have to activate their plans, which are detailed and extensive. Even so, urged on by regulators and organizations such as the World Health Organization, these banks are trying to make sure they are prepared to deal with an outbreak that could affect a significant portion of their employees and will test their ability to manage their business when staff are unable to travel and in some cases staying away from the office. These preparations are not necessarily different to other industries, but given the importance of the financial system to the overall functioning of the economy, governments and regulators are taking a close interest in banks and insurers. Financial institutions have plenty of practice in disaster planning. Following the attacks on New York in September 2001, most large banks have adopted detailed contingency plans, while regulators have set up procedures for monitoring the markets in the event of another attack. One has to wonder whether or not these plans that were formulated after 9/11 will be adequate. Nothing that was done before or after 9/11 seems to be adequate, except for borrowing and printing more and more money to keep the economy blazing, when in fact the natural course of events after the bombing of New York would have been an implosion of our economy. Our economy survives because of an artificial monitoring of the system and the printing of trillions and trillions of dollars in Washington, D.C. Now that Red China has decided to cash in much of its paper dollar stock, the fake phony paper money is beginning to suffer a serious decline worldwide. Much of the report that you have heard comes from the Financial Times, where more information on this subject can be found. Our enemies in Mexico, as well as diplomats from Central America, are now demanding guest worker programs in the United States and the legalization of undocumented migrants. These diplomats have criticized a U.S. proposal for tougher border enforcement. Meeting in Mexico's capital, the regional officials have pledged to do more to fight migrant trafficking, but indirectly condemned a U.S. bill that would make illegal entry a felony and extend border walls. "Migrants, regardless of their migratory status, should not be treated like criminals," they said in their issued statement. The countries represented at the meeting were typical third world unsuccessful nations, including El Salvador, Nicaragua, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Belize, and Panama, who have all created a working group to design a regional policy to avoid migrant abuse and to follow the course of the legislation. Can you imagine the chutzpah that these people have in doing this? This is absolutely amazing that people from another country would try to tell the United States what it should do on its own border. These people have become so used to watching their people come across the border and to send billions and billions of dollars a month back to their own people, that they're beginning to think that it's their due, that the border is now so mushy that they themselves have some say over whether it is open or closed. Mexican Foreign Relations Secretary Luis Ernesto Derbez said that there has to be an integrated reform that includes a temporary worker program, but also the regularization of those people who are already living in receptor countries. So that is what we are now in the United States, a receptor country. But there's something very sexual about that reference, and I think we know that we are the ones who are being bent over by the Mexicans, the Nicaraguans, Guatemalans, and the rest of these unsuccessful countries. In my opinion, we are not here to be bested by a small bunch of thugs and radicals from Central America who have begun to think that what is their due is to take their crummiest people and shove them across the border into the United States, where the vast majority of them remain unemployed, and many of them end up in jails, some of them committing things as heinous as murder, rape, and burglaries. It's very difficult to understand why the United States government continues to persist in working with these foreign diplomats on turning our country over to their particular unwanted personages who are constantly pouring in across our border. We have no responsibility to take these people, and Mexicans working in the United States right now are a huge source of revenue for the Mexicans, sending home more than $16 billion in remittances in the year 2004. And even more the next year, and even more will be sent this year. Of course, Mexico's second largest source of foreign currency after oil exports, according to the country's central bank, is the currencies that are sent there from the United States of America. Nonetheless, it is not our responsibility to hire their citizens. It is our responsibility to protect our own citizens and to protect our border from this ongoing incursion. The Jewish world bankers, whose hegemony over the United States, Mexico, and all of these other countries, believes that the intermixing of all nations and races together into a kind of hodgepodge will help them in securing their place as the masters of our world. They already have trillions and trillions of dollars in their pocket, but that evidently is not enough, and it was never enough. Ever since the French Revolution, the Rothschild family has spent money to make money, spending money to bribe politicians, to start wars, to buy up arms plants and uniform factories, where they can make money and enjoy the fruits of their labor, as we war against each other in the never-ending battle against Jewish hegemony. Somewhere and sometime in the nearness of our lives, we must come to grips with this particular menace to all of our peoples. The sooner that we toss off the yoke of the colonial Jewish supremacists, those who are dipping their fangs into our shoulders and our throats, drawing money from our very lifeblood day by day, minute by minute, these people must be sent away and kept from us so that we will be free to breathe and live our lives without exploitation. And as long as they remain here, they shall be a threat to us. For the Jewish supremacists are Trojan horses that are placed inside of our cities, the same way that Ulysses placed the Trojan horse inside of Troy during the Greek-Trojan War, and then came back the next day and fought the battle that destroyed Troy. These people, by living within our shores, represent the dangerous Trojan horses who are spying on us, who are leveling taxes upon us, and who are, through their lobbying of our Congress and of our President, taking control of the reins of power here, so that even without lifting a sword, they have been able to bleed us dry. Meanwhile, their pop artist of hate, Abraham Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League, goes around the country and the world screaming hate, when in fact the real hate is the Jewish supremacy hate, the hate of a racist group of people who don't care what other races they destroy, as long as they can make money in the process. Anyone mentioning this obvious fact is immediately branded as an anti-Semitic and a racist, when in fact it's exactly what is happening, and many people have taken notice. They understand the years of trickery that have been forced down their throats by the Jewish supremacy newspapers, which represent a monopoly in the United States of America, whose music has flattered our children into worshiping thugs who sing about niggas and bitches and about killing the police. It is well past time that we take back our country, our music, our news, our movie studios, and our government. We must also take the banks, so that the Jewish supremacists will never again have the funds with which to enthrone themselves in other people's countries, to tell their governments what to do, and to be the colonialists of this world. Colonies were supposed to have gone out years ago, at the end of World War II. But that war only served to further strengthen the greed of the Jewish hegemony. The banks, the militarists, and all of the others who have surrounded us, so that we, here in these countries, must act like settlers circling our wagons for protection against their onslaught. And the onslaught continues, and the wars continue, and now we are bogged down in Iraq, simply because of that tiny little terror state known as Israel, which has made the United States into its whipping boy, so that our soldiers are over in Iraq doing their bidding. Meanwhile, just so you'll know that everything is all right in America, the Jew Howard Stern on Sirius Radio has continued to peddle his filth successfully, having earned over $500 million in his move to Sirius Radio, where the FCC cannot bother him. Some of the highlights from Tuesday's show include Star Trek star and Stern sidekick George Takei emerging as the show's new critical darling. Tuesday's opening segment was dedicated to Takei's debut, which drew rave reviews. Everyone agreed George was a home run, Stern said. Callers throughout the broadcast praised Takei's performance. Stern reflected on his first day on Sirius that yesterday was such a great day for me. Giddy with the possibilities, I thought we did a really good first show. Howard Stern continued to go after David Lee Roth, his replacement on CBS Radio, for not taking his call Monday, which he said was a silly move and it would have been good for him to take the call. Tom Petty's The Last DJ, an ode to disc jockeys who still have freedom on the air, appears to be Stern's unofficial theme song. After calling Stern's show violent offensive, Takei paraphrased Voltaire, quote, I detest what you say, but I would give my life to make it possible for you to continue to say it, unquote. Ironically, Stern and Robin Quivers complained about the lack of commercials throughout the show. Quote, I was going to urinate and there's no time for anything during the show, unquote. Takei debated the merits of gay marriage with Arnold Schwarzenegger's impersonator. Stern and Crew spent a large chunk of time discussing the fact that staffer J.D. Harmeyer, 26, lost his virginity. A news flash scrolled across the Cirrus screen, saying J.D. loses his virginity. Stern continued to pick on Takei, among his comments, quote, you would be more a giver than a receiver, unquote. The Stern gang played clips of Dick Clark's New Year's Eve performance. Stern said to Takei, quote, George, would you say that it's the worst dick you've seen, unquote. So, there goes America, Howard Stern. How could everything be so good? How could everything be so right? How could the Jewish supremacists not hold their heads up high when, in fact, they have put one great big Stern over all of us? A filthy Stern, but a Stern nonetheless. I realize that we need to have a sense of humor about things like this, because things will get worse before they get better. But they will get better. Much of this story was prepared by USA Today, where you can find more on Howard Stern and on many other entertainers. According to Arab News of Sharon's brutalities and failures, he was brutal, he was ugly, he was criminal, of the kind associated with war. Sharon was known as the bulldozer, not only because Ariel Sharon weighed as much as one, but because for decades he strutted around our homeland, meaning the Arab homeland, acting like one. And indeed, what size stroke would he have suffered last week other than a massive one? A stroke that, by deadline Sunday, still left him alive but with permanent damage to areas of the brain that control speech, faculty of analysis, and motor response, producing huge odds against his survival, let alone his ability to function again as a political leader. You cannot overstate how much Palestinians loathe the man. His lifelong war against them began with dreadful massacres, proceeded on to land grabs, and ended with a fraudulent disengagement plan designed to put their dream of independence, as one of his top advisors called it, in formaldehyde. Among the many massacres, raids, and mopping-up operations Sharon mounted against the people of Palestine, the one inscribed in their collective memory on par with Deir Yassin, none matches the one in the village of Kibia in the West Bank, perpetrated by Israel's Unit 101, which he commanded, on the night of October 15, 1953. Presumably as a reprisal against the killing of three Israelis by Palestinian refugees, enraged at seeing their own land across the border being tilled by European immigrants, Unit 101 entered the village and blew up 45 houses with their inhabitants inside. 67 men, women, and children perished, and Israel's occupation of the two small remnants of the Palestinian people's homeland left them after 1948 had not even started yet. But soon after it did, Sharon was soon there to demonstrate his savagery. Between 1967 and 1970, after the resistance began to show its first stirrings in Gaza, Sharon, as commander of the Southern Front, mounted one of the most brutal campaigns in modern history to stamp it out. In August 1970, after entering Gaza, he moved his troops from street to street, neighborhood to neighborhood, refugee camp to refugee camp, orange grove to orange grove, where, using their commander's weapon of choice, the bulldozer, they demolished thousands of homes and uprooted large portions of the strip's groves, the region's only crop. Orders were given to shoot terrorist suspects without questions being asked, and over 1,000 people were executed. Clearly, such collective punishments perpetrated against a helpless people under occupation contravened the Geneva Conventions, and the extrajudicial killings of civilians were strictly forbidden by international law, which defines them as war crimes. But the man got away with it and went on to become Israel's defense minister in 1982 when he launched the devastating invasion of Lebanon that year, which concluded with the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, massacres that he was held indirectly responsible for by an Israeli court of inquiry. As to what that term means precisely, we do not know. In June 1974, outside Nablus, a group of fanatic settlers, hell-bent on establishing another illegal settlement of Palestinian lands, were resisting soldiers who had been ordered by Yitzhak Rabin's centrist government to evict them. Then who would stroll into the midst of the screaming, kicking, and chanting mob other than the ex-general and now newly elected Knesset member? Ariel Sharon, who proceeded to urge the soldiers to resist orders, after the right wrested control of the government in 1977 and the expansionist Menachem Begin was appointed prime minister, Sharon truly came into his own as the architect of Israel's settlement policy. He never wavered in his pursuit of that policy despite his crafty withdrawal from Gaza late last year, which was intended to consolidate his grip on the West Bank and block the emergence of a future Palestinian state. After all these years, after all these massacres he has committed, after all the grief he has caused, after all his attempts to subdue the people of Palestine, Sharon has failed, and failed miserably. Ariel Sharon leaves the scene with his dream of a greater Israel in tatters, a joke, a lunatically improbable goal in the first place. The international community, along with many people in the U.S., but excluding dorks like the evangelist Pat Robertson and his equally dorky followers, has turned against Israel, much because of his actions. This elegant story about Sharon was crafted by Fawaz Turkey and was printed in the Arab News, the Middle East's leading English language daily, where much more about Sharon and other leaders of occupied Palestine can be found. We at Jewwatch have noticed for years the brutality of Ariel Sharon. And although it's not very nice to talk about somebody when he's dying and incapacitated and can't really defend himself, there really is no defense for what Ariel Sharon has done in his brutal lifetime. A similar but somewhat quite different viewpoint of Sharon was found in the Socialist Worker Online, which refers to Ariel Sharon as the butcher of Beirut and not a man of peace. They point out that the media is presenting critically ill Israeli leader Ariel Sharon as a peacemaker, but Palestinian Fatima Hilu looks at his brutal record and finds his life to be far different. Of course, what would you expect from a Zionist-owned press, other than having articles praising the life of Ariel Sharon? In this story, we read that the first time I heard of Ariel Sharon was the evening of 16 September 1982. I was 10 and lived with my family in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp on the outskirts of Beirut. Our camp was surrounded by Israeli troops and their Lebanese phalangist fascist allies. All our fighters had withdrawn from the camps under a peace deal that ended the Israeli siege of the Lebanese capital. We were defenseless, but our safety was guaranteed by the international community. Then a neighbor screamed, "Sharon is here! Sharon is here! We have seen him at the sports stadium." I did not know who Sharon was at the time, but his name filled all Palestinians with fear. In August 1953, his elite forces raided the Al-Barig refugee camp in the Gaza Strip and killed up to 50 refugees. In October of that year, he organized another massacre, this time of 69 civilians in the West Bank village of Kibia. His soldiers would often slaughter people they captured. During the 1967 war, he executed over 100 Palestinian prisoners. Now he was leading the charge by the Israeli army into Lebanon. In September 1982, he reached our camp. People began to panic, but none of us could have foreseen the horror Ariel Sharon would unleash on us over the next 36 hours. The first to die were the people caught trying to escape the cordon around our camp. When we started to hear that representatives from the civilian committee who went to negotiate were not returning. That evening, the Israelis and the phalangists started to fire on the camp from the sports stadium. A neighbor came to our house with her two daughters. She was screaming that the phalangists had entered the camp and killed her two sons. All night we could hear the sound of death around us as family after family were killed in their homes. My brothers fled to the Gaza hospital on the edge of the camp, hoping to find refuge. My mother and I found refuge in the mosque. My father decided to hide in the house. Militiamen discovered us and marched us out of the camp. It was then that we saw the Israeli soldiers. They taunted us. As the militia and the Israelis marched us along the main road, we were joined by other survivors. Among them was a friend and her family. With her was a neighbor who was trying to stop the bleeding from a large wound in her stomach. She later died. A disabled man called Abu Muhammad al-Dokhek was forced to march with us. He was too slow, so they killed him. My friend's father tried to escape, but they shot him as well. During this march, I came across the body of my cousin. She had been raped and was lying naked in the street. Her father was lying dead in the alleyway. The rest of her family were killed on her doorstep. As women tried to flee down an alleyway, they caught her and beat her to death. People began to panic as we realized we were all going to be murdered. Two Israeli soldiers came up to my mother and me. My mother pleaded with them in Hebrew. One of them said, "Run or you will die." We ran and escaped to the Gaza hospital. The hospital was full of people seeking shelter, but the staff said they could not protect us. They were all later murdered. We were crammed into cars and escaped. My father and brother survived, but were arrested and handed over to the Lebanese army. Many people disappeared after they were arrested. Politicians and the media are now presenting Sharon as a man of peace, but for me, he will always be the butcher of Beirut. And these were the recollections of a small girl who survived the brutalities of Ariel Sharon. It is difficult to even begin to imagine the horror that this young girl had gone through, and the fear that entered her heart. This is part of the brutality of terrorism. And the worst terrorism in the world has not been the jihad, but it has been the Israeli terrorism. Terrorism of the Israeli terror state. The terror of Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. Killers of thousands. People who are hated by all Palestinians because of what they did to them. This story was presented at ArabNews.com, where you will find many more stories of excellent quality concerning Palestine, concerning all of the countries of the Middle East. ArabNews.com. The Jews just didn't become terrorists all at once. They'd been practicing for years in the Soviet Union. They ran the Red Revolution, and then they ran the USSR itself as a killer state, in which they killed more than 65 million white Christians. According to Jew Watch, concerning the Jews and communism, out of 556 important functionaries of the Bolshevik state, there were in 1918-1919 457 Jews, but only 17 Russians, 2 Ukrainians, 11 Armenians, 35 Letts, 15 Germans, 1 Hungarian, 10 Georgians, 4 Poles, 5 Finns, and 1 Karaim. 457 of the 556 important functionaries of the Bolshevik state were, you guessed it, Jewish people. This fact comes from The Days of the Romanovs by Robert Wilton, published by T. Butterworth of London in 1920, George H. Darin Publishers, New York, 1920, and reprinted by the Institute for Historical Review. Other publications which support this data on Jew Watch include the Encyclopedia Britannica, Surrender of the Empire by Nesta H. Webster, and the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia. Sometimes we forget how wretched things were between 1920 and 1940, and how for some people in the Soviet Union, World War II might even have been a respite, because Hitler's war against Russia killed far fewer Russians in many areas than Stalin himself killed. Stalin was married to a Jewess, and some say to 3 Jewesses, and his name, his original name, was Dushvegli, which means little Jewesson. Although it is claimed that Stalin is not a Jew, we can tell by his name, by his wives, by his politics, that he was Jewish through and through. In fact, he was able to upstage most of the Jews of the Revolution, killing many of them, and being even more brutal than his predecessor, Lenin, who was raised in a Yiddish household and also married a Jewish woman, so that he too could be a part of the Jewish family. The Jewish supremacists. It's difficult to beat them, and it's almost impossible to join them. And now for something on the lighter side, a defense of Pat Robertson by a Christian apologist. Written by Newt Berger, we read, "Yes, maybe the end of times have come." A couple of weeks ago in this column, I found myself defending the Reverend Jerry Falwell over the issue of Christmas. And today I find myself wondering why televangelist Pat Robertson, host of the 700 Club, founder of the Christian Coalition, and sometimes prayer buddy of George W. Bush, has suddenly become a pariah. Mr. Berger tells us that Robertson was roundly criticized last week for his remarks regarding Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's life-threatening stroke. He said that Robertson, invoking the words of the biblical prophet Joel, suggested that God was punishing Sharon for dividing Israel by giving Gaza to the Palestinians. Robertson had said, quote, God has enmity between those who divide my land, and I would say woe unto any prime minister of Israel who takes a similar course to appease the European Union, the United Nations, or the United States of America. God says, this land belongs to me. You better leave it alone, unquote. Sharon's massive cerebral hemorrhage was God's doing, Robertson was saying. The remarks generated instant outrage. As a Christian apologist, the author goes on to point out how newspapers and politicians around the world criticized Pat Robertson severely. Then he goes on to say, whether or not you agree with Sharon's politics or Robertson's faith or timing, surely speculating that God had a hand in things is not an unprecedented concept for the region. It's very familiar to anyone who reads and believes in the words of the Bible. Is anyone surprised that Pat Robertson is a Christian fundamentalist? We know, he says, contrary to what Foxman says, that's Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League, who criticized Pat Robertson severely. We know, contrary to what Foxman says, that the God of the Bible is often cruel, dealing plagues, locusts, boils, and misery upon individuals. Just ask Job, as well as untold generations. In Genesis, God floods the earth and wipes out almost all of humankind because of our wickedness. In Revelation, he orders the 7 golden bowls of his wrath to be poured upon humanity. In between, he expects strict religious and political obedience. God of the Bible is angry from the beginning to end. He is territorial, political, and actively engaged in human affairs, especially the affairs of the Middle East. With this profile, smiting Ariel Sharon seems entirely in character. Rather than Robertson's remarks being unchristian and a perversion of religion, they seem very true to its word. And that was an article by Newt Berger in the Seattle Times. Many times when people like Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell are invited to appear on television is because of something ridiculous that they have said, such as Jerry Falwell criticizing one of the Teletubbies for possibly being gay. Sometimes I think that Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell were selected by the Jewish media because they are just a bit ridiculous at times, and it's kind of fun to bring people like that onto the air and discuss things with them while some learned Jewish scholars sit back and comment. So that Robertson and Falwell sometimes become a kind of straw man, people who are somewhat stupid on occasion and say the wrong thing. And so this straw man becomes a kind of false icon representing all of Christianity, as though all Christians would act in that particular manner when in fact they would not. This is one of the ways in which the Jewish-owned media demonstrates the ridiculousness of Christianity, and does so in a deceitful manner, having selected the very people that they wish to use as icons of Christianity while playing pin the tail on the donkey during their news programs. Unless you haven't noticed, on the Jewish media, the Christians don't have a chance. Shin Bet, which is an organization that constantly lies and is not to be trusted, has said that 3,000 rifles have been smuggled into Gaza. Have they or have they not? We really can't be sure. Are they setting us up so that they can reinvade Gaza? Is this just another excuse and another piece of disinformation in a nation that has constantly lied about what it is doing? The amount of weapons, this story says, smuggled into Egypt, into the Gaza Strip, has increasingly and dramatically escalated since Israel's withdrawal from the region. The smuggling of weapons and explosives from Egypt to the Gaza Strip has increased in comparison to the period preceding the disengagement, Knesset's Foreign Affairs and Defense Minister said. If before the disengagement 200 to 300 rifles were smuggled a month, today we're talking about 3,000, unquote. So there you have the statement from Shin Bet, but what can you believe? These people have lied for the past 50 years. I relay the story for scholars to study and to take notice of. We have so much propaganda going on all fronts in Israel and in the Middle East right now that it seems like it's a very dangerous time, because when we hear about rifles being smuggled here and nuclear armaments being prepared there, we can be pretty sure that we're being set up for an increased war of some type. Propaganda is the name of the game. If you want to have a war, you must first churn the fields, churn the surf, churn the sand, churn the wind, churn everything with speculation about how evil a so-called enemy might be. At the beginning of World War I, we were originally told how wonderful the Germans were. Our newspaper said the Germans were great, the Germans were this, the Germans were that. And the Brits were not too good, nor were the French. But as soon as the Jewish supremacists got the Balfour Declaration and then propagandized us that the Germans were bad, I went to the president and said, either you enter this war or we will tell the American people that you slept with your secretary when you were at Princeton. That was President Wilson. And the story was related by a man who should know, Benjamin Friedman, who was a part of the Jewish cabal to bring about our entry into World War I and into World War II, and who later wised up at the communist menace, which was mostly Jews, and he outed the Jews. He went around the country. He was rich. He had started the Woodbury Soap Company, and he used the last $1 million he had to go around the country and to warn the Americans that the Jews were coming, that the Jews had been here and they were coming again and again and again to the White House to eat from the trough, to force the president and the Congress to do everything that they wanted to have done, including wasting their fortune on world wars in which we had absolutely no business being involved, because those wars did not affect us. World War II was about Germany versus the Soviet Union. Why in the world would the United States want to enter a war like that? They wouldn't. But the Jews in the White House, like Morgenthau, were constantly working with Roosevelt, who, if you will read Jew Watch, you will find his lineage, and he is also a person of Jewish descent, as was his wife Eleanor. In fact, they are practically kissing cousins, not only with the Jews, but with themselves. But that isn't the point. The point is that Jewish hegemony and Jewish supremacism is constantly a factor in these wars. And right now, as you see in this story, Shin Bet is talking about rifles being smuggled into Gaza. Why would he be discussing this? What possibility would rifles have to harm Israel, that is loaded with rifles, loaded with ammunition of all types? You have one of the largest armies in the world in Israel. It's huge. I was in Israel years ago and I watched the parachute show on the beach. It was frightening. It was absolutely frightening. I didn't know it was a parachute show, and I saw all these people coming into shore in huge ships. I saw tanks being pushed out of airplanes and then being floated to the shore. And I got the hell out of there. I thought, wow, I'm in the middle of an invasion here. I didn't know if it was the Israelis. I didn't know if it was the Arabs. I figured it was the Arabs. I went about a half a mile into Tel Aviv until I was told, oh no, this is a parachute show and everybody's here to watch it. So like everyone else, I enjoy a good show. And nothing's a better show than war or the military. And so I found a nice viewpoint from which to watch it. And I really enjoyed myself thoroughly. If it had been a real war, it would have been probably very frightening and possibly painful and deadly to me. But it wasn't. It was simply a show. Are we looking at a show when the Shin Bet says that 3,000 rifles a month are being smuggled into Gaza? Or are we being set up for an invasion of Gaza again by the next president or prime minister of the terror state of Israel? And further north, we find all of these stories about nuclear weapons being developed by Iran. And we know that our president would love to go into Iran and into Syria, because it would make him known as the greatest wartime president since Lyndon Baines Johnson. Of course, Lyndon had to resign, and Bush isn't looking too good either. And he can't even win the war in Iraq, but what the heck? Mr. Bush is evidently a gambler, and besides, his Jewish friends are telling him that he must do this. He must go into Iraq, he must go into Iran, he must do everything that the Jews want. Because their hegemony over the Middle East depends on the United States of America doing their will. It's a case of the tail wagging the dog. The tail doesn't have a whole lot of money, but it doesn't take a whole lot of money to corrupt the congressman. All it takes is a little money and a few people like Jack Abramoff. According to a report in the New Zealand Herald, New Zealand police are helping monitor incursions of Russian gangsters, which means, of course, Jewish gangsters. New Zealand police are working with Australian authorities, the FBI, and Interpol, to root out these Jewish Russian gangsters, including some former KGB agents who have infiltrated Australasia, and the Australian Federal Police are on their tail. Sydney's Sunday Telegraph reported that the Russian gangsters have been establishing extortion, gun running, and prostitution rackets, and are also involved in fraud, drugs, and blackmail. All of them Jewish pursuits, at least pursuits of the Jewish mafia in all countries in the world. Russian Jewish criminals, renowned for their audacity and efficiency, have already established a foothold, according to the New Zealand Herald, in Australia. According to a report from the two agencies, the report said some of the criminals were former members of the KGB, where they learned skills such as debugging, computer hacking, and strategic recruitment. Their activities in Australia have so far centered on Sydney, especially Bondi, and the Gold Coast, and extortion victims have mainly involved members of the emigre Russian community. Australia's Customs Minister Chris Ellison said, in conjunction with New Zealand police and other partner agencies domestically and internationally, that they were conducting proactive initiatives to monitor the Jewish Russian criminals and garner a greater understanding of their threat. 2 years ago, the paper notes, Russian gangsters kidnapped a wealthy New Zealand company director, Nikolai Valentinovich, 59, while he was visiting Vladivostok. Mr. Valentinovich was living in a $1.6 million home at Remuera in Auckland when he disappeared on July 20, 2003. Moscow newspaper Moskovsky Komsomolets reported Mr. Valentinovich was former co-owner of the Rossi Group of companies in Russia with interests in oil, and at least two of his business partners were former KGB officers. About 6 months ago, Mr. Valentinovich was visited in New Zealand by a former assistant manager of the KGB, another Jew who met with him and other former Jewish business partners, the newspaper reported at the time. Last year, a lawyer for two Jewish Russians who arrived in New Zealand on stolen Israeli passports told a New Zealand court they had been advised by mafia types this country was a soft touch. So there you have it. New Zealand, Australia, just like America, being invaded by Jewish Russian thugs. And so goes Jewish hegemony in our world. And of course, anyone who discusses this is immediately branded by Abraham Foxman as an anti-Semite. And now for a story from Dar el Hayat, which is more an opinion column by Jihad el Kazan, who says that lobbyist Jack Abramoff pleaded guilty to committing crimes in his dealings with the U.S. politicians, most of them Republicans, and his name has been linked till now with Congressman Tom DeLay, the former Republican Majority Leader in Congress, and Bob Ney, the chairman of the House Administration Committee. However, until now, Mr. Kazan says, the investigation has shown that 2001 saw more than 1,000 calls between the lobbying firm Abramoff headed and members of Congress. Around 200 calls to the Bush administration during the first 10 months in office. Can you imagine 1,000 calls in the year 2001 alone, and 200 calls to the Bush administration during Bush's first 10 months in office? Now, in this indictment, according to this author, Kazan, Representative Ney appears under the name Representative Number 1, but the indictment leaves no doubt that the accusations will reach many more congressmen. The author says that Abramoff admitted in front of a federal court in Pennsylvania 3 felony charges of conspiracy, mail fraud, and tax evasion. This was in return for a lesser sentence. It had been open-ended, but now it stands, according to the author, at 10 years in prison and a $25 million fine. At a federal court in Miami, Abramoff confessed to conspiracy and fraud charges involving the purchase of gambling votes. Michael Scanlon, Abramoff's lobbying partner, had earlier pled guilty in exchange for a reduced sentence. David Safafian, a former high-ranking Bush administration employee, was accused of trying to hide from investigators that Abramoff tried to obtain government work when Safafian went on a golf trip with him to Scotland, one in which Ney also took part. The author says that since he has resided in Washington and closely followed Congress, he's not surprised by the details. He states that some congressmen are so cheap that they will accept a gift trip or a simple present, even an invitation to drinks or dinner, in exchange for services such as supporting draft bills for certain lobbies or entering statements into the congressional record. At the courtroom, Abramoff was asked if he had provided things of value for an official act. "Yes, Your Honor," he answered. "You've committed tax evasion?" "Yes, Your Honor," he answered. "You filed false and fraudulent forms?" "Yes, Your Honor." The only yes that caught my attention, according to this author, was when he was asked about Capital Athletic Foundation, namely whether Abramoff had sought to misrepresent its work, and Abramoff admitted it and said yes. According to the author, this foundation, Capital Athletic Foundation, supposedly helps young people in the United States play sport and receive vocational training. The contributors to the foundation were thus promised access to DeLay, who until September of last year was the head of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. He resigned under the weight of the scandal of fundraising violations for his Texas election campaign. Jack Abramoff, who is an Orthodox Jew, received many donations from Native American tribes, which he defrauded out of more than $60 million, of which $20 million went into his pocket. The tribes then realized that their donations were going to support extremist Jewish settlers against Palestinians. Michael Isikoff, in Newsweek on the 2nd of February 2005, revealed that more than $140,000 in donations to the foundation were spent on buying sniper scopes, night vision binoculars, camouflage suits, thermal imagers, and other equipment for settlers to use against Palestinians. It turned out that a friend of Orthodox Jew Abramoff was Samuel ben Zvi, a leader of extremist Jews from the Betar Elit settlement, who receives a monthly check from his friend. They're all an Israeli gang. 2 of Abramoff's employees immigrated to Israel after the scandal erupted, according to the author. Their names are Sam Hook and his wife, Shauna Sesler. They're all ultra-Orthodox Jews, and one of Abramoff's employees said that he was a rabid Zionist. Tom DeLay denied any knowledge of Abramoff's foundation, according to the author, although he can't deny that he told a Stand for Israel rally of fundamentalist Christians in April 2003 that the United States stands for justice, and that means we stand for Israel. According to the author, it's nasty talk, like the corrupt person who said it. If there's terror in the Middle East, it's terror by the government of Israeli terrorists against Palestinians. The Israeli figures say that 4 Palestinian civilians have been killed for each Israeli civilian in the Second Intifada. 6 Palestinian children have been killed for each Israeli child. But Tom DeLay, corrupt as he is, doesn't see the blood of Palestinian schoolgirls, according to this author, from his position in Abramoff's pocket. And he works against the interest of his country, as he supports crimes by a small country, so small that he's become its partner against 1.2 billion Muslims around the planet. And the Americans still ask, why do they hate us? According to this author, the U.S. policy is odious to Arabs. And he says he's only talking about the Middle East. The reason is that the existence of people like Tom DeLay in decision-making positions make the wrong decisions. He's not the worst, the author says, since there are many others in Congress who consider themselves Israelis and have only one loyalty, not two. And they are there to promote Israel's interests against all other interests, including that of their own country. And he uses their own country in quotes, because Israel is who they are acting for and not their own country. The author says, if we add to these the unelected neoconservatives or Judeocons in and around the administration, we find that this Jewish mafia has done away with America's friends in the world, not just among Arabs and Muslims. He means the entire world. I don't think the White House will do anything to improve its reputation, the author says. Neither among Arabs nor Muslims, as long as Dick Cheney and not George Bush is running the show. However, the author says, Cheney is still facing possible charges himself, with his former office director, Louis Libby, whose real name is Irwin Libowitz. Cheney is still facing possible charges himself with his former office director, Libowitz, while the latter is facing an indictment alone. Logic says that the case can't be separated from Libowitz's boss, who, along with Libowitz, sought to cook up intelligence information about banned weapons in Iraq and the country's alleged links to Al-Qaeda. The author says that justice is turned on its head as Abramoff, the Orthodox Jew and Zionist, rabid Zionist, actually, goes on trial on bribery charges and not participating in Israeli crimes against Palestinians, which are the charges that the author would like to see, or crimes of participating in Israeli terror against Palestinians. He says that he finds American justice once again turned on its head as Abramoff goes on trial, and people like Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, and Douglas Feith remain free. And the author, Mr. Kazan, says justice should catch up to them one day. And this article, which is an opinion piece with plenty of facts, was reprinted at Dar al-Hayat on the Internet. You've been listening to The World Today, and my name is Frank Weltner. I am the librarian for Jew Watch, and I would like to welcome you here every day of the week to read the articles that we have assembled for you at Jew Watch, as well as the research that we constantly prepare and print at JewWatch.com. We are indeed living in a dangerous world, a world of Jewish supremacy, in which people like Jack Abramoff and other Jews that are associated with him funnel money to our congressmen in return for getting them to vote money for the Jewish terror state. This type of treason must end, and we must rid our country of traitors who wish our country to represent Israel and not to represent itself. Every dollar that is removed from America for Israel is a dollar that we don't have for ourselves, and it's also a dollar that we have used to buy hatred from the Arabs, from the Europeans, from the Chinese, or from everyone who looks at America and how it operates and how it panders to Israel and can't believe its eyes. You're listening to The World Today. My name is Frank Weltner. Please come often to Jew Watch for our radio shows, for our research, for all of the important news and comment that you require to understand what is going on in the world at large. Thank you very much.